the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's MadTech Podcast. I'm Grace Dillon, editor at ExchangeWire, and this week I'm joined by Femi Taiwo, head of consultancy Europe at Assembly. How are you, Femi?
I'm well, thank you. Thank you for having me, Grace. How are you doing?
Good, thank you. No worries. Great to have you here. And also joining me, still from the land down under, is ExchangeWire CSO Rachel Smith. How are you, Rachel?
I'm very good, thank you, Grace, albeit ready for bed. It's the wrong time of the day for me, but that's what happens when you're upside down and on the other side of the world.
Well, we appreciate you being here, Rachel, as always.
Not at all. My pleasure.
Wonderful. We'll get started with the three news stories of the week, starting with the CEO of Google and Alphabet Inc. has been accused of approving what has been deemed an illegal deal between the search leader and Facebook. According to a new court filing in a case brought by a coalition of US states' attorneys general, Sundar Pichai personally signed off on an agreement that would kill a competing advertising tool. The Google Digital Advertising Antitrust Litigation alleges that Google sought to maintain their dominance by forging a deal with Facebook that would deter the social media giant from using the rival tool. The agreement, which was codenamed Jedi Blue, reportedly gave Facebook a competitive advantage in online ad auctions carried out via Google and saw the firm win at least 10% of all the auctions they entered. The filing asserts that Pichai and Meta Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg both personally gave their blessing to the terms, with Sandberg describing the pact as a big deal strategically in an email to Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg. In a statement, a Google spokesperson said that the complaint is full of inaccuracies and lacks legal merit, and the company have since actually filed a motion to dismiss the claim. Meta, who are not defendants in the case, said that the deal was positive for advertisers and publishers by generating greater competition for ad placements. So, knowledge of the alleged agreement isn't new. It came out slightly earlier, I think around July last year. But this is sort of the first news that there was high-level executive knowledge of the deal or involvement in the establishment of the pact. So what impact do you think that these accusations could have on Google and on, you know, Sundar Pichai as well? Femi, I'll come to you first.
I think this is interesting on a sort of number of fronts. The first is if the email chain is, is full and sort of in an unredacted version and sort of details out what the Texan government and the other states are saying, then that's a smoking gun, as far as I'm concerned. You know, it's yet to be seen. You know, between the statements in Google and Facebook, it seems as though there is an acceptance that Facebook was involved in the auctions. But of course, Facebook's logic is that, you know, we were fostering competition, not hindering it. And, you know, who knows what context this could be a big deal strategically, could mean from a Sandberg to Zuckerberg sort of communication. So I think that's the first interesting thing. The second one is, if you look at it sort of as a wider piece, Texas is being very aggressive with how it's going after big tech right now, you know, specifically Google. So I think they've also done something around location ads and on sort of or local ads on audio, you know, and sort of suing Google on that account as well. So there is very much a tide turning, as it were, from at least from US states and sort of from our end internally at Assembly. I guess one of the things that we're keeping an eye on are inflection points over the next 18 months, right? We think, or rather we expect there's going to be one at some point this year where the US finally lands on a federal law that's more stringent around privacy, right? And maybe this becomes a tipping point, but I don't yet see a smoking gun, if I'm being very honest, right? I just see a bunch of allegations and I guess a very, very well-staffed Google with a bunch of lawyers that can probably bat them down quite easily, if I'm being honest. But who knows what comes out in the next version of this motion.
Good point. I mean, this isn't the only antitrust case that Google are facing in the US. They're facing, from my memory, at least three other ones from, you know, other AG coalitions and, you know, from the Department of Justice and the FTC. So there's a lot of legal action going on. Do you think that this particular case in combination with, you know, the other investigations could kind of break Google down in a way, or maybe not structurally, but force some sort of change to their operations? Rachel, what do you think?
Well, sometimes these days when we start talking about all of the sort of antitrust complaints that are heading Google's way, I feel a little bit like we could substitute the word Google for Boris Johnson. It's like, how many more allegations need to be brought forward before somebody takes some action? Pardon me for getting political in the middle of the Mantech podcast, but I couldn't resist it. So in answer to your question, Grace, do I think that this is going to wind up, you know, sort of creating some kind of momentum and resulting in perhaps Google being forced to divest of some element of the ad tech business? It's so hard to answer because nothing along those lines has happened yet, but it's hard to imagine that we won't end up in that territory because, connected to what Femi mentioned before, there are some, you know, states and some individuals within those states and organizations within those states that are so aggressively heading down either privacy or anti-competition routes that I just can't imagine that heat's going to back off. Of course, this specific case will come down to whether the allegations that have been made can be proven, and if they are proven, you know, whether those allegations are indeed represented accurately. It's possible that this is indeed something that happened within Google and across Facebook, but who knows, maybe it was exaggerated. So it will come, you know, this particular case will come down to the specifics, but in a more general sense, it's hard to imagine that the pressure on Google and the way that it operates and runs its advertising technology business is going to start disintegrating. I see the opposite trend, I think. And quite frankly, there's a part of me that thinks, you know, if you were Google, why wouldn't you now just start making moves to organize yourself differently? It's hard to imagine that divesting of at least some part of their ad tech business would be so disruptive to their overall main business that they couldn't get on with things. Surely there is a way for them to move away from their ad tech stack and still do extraordinarily well as a business. And if I was Sanjay, I'd be thinking, could we maybe just do that? Because I've had enough of being in the news, and, you know, maybe it's something that will wind up appeasing regulators and, you know, various legislative organizations and sort of head them off at the pass. Because, you know, Femi also gave a nod to it in his opening statement. This is a really, really serious set of allegations, this specific case. And if it is found to be accurate and to be true, it's evidence of, you know, senior executives at companies deal fixing. And that's a federal crime. People could wind up doing jail time over this. So, you know, if I was working in Google at the moment and very senior in that organization, I'd want to be thinking how I'm going to get myself out of this, no matter what the outcome of this particular case is. Femi, I don't know what you think.
You know what? I'm glad you went to the Boris Johnson element, and because I was in two minds whether I was going to or not. But I think that there is probably one line in the first motion that really struck my attention in the lawsuit that we got from our redacted documents, which was that one publisher complained about Google telling them that, in effect, header bidding was having a strain in their service, right? And for me, that was a really important line, because I thought, if you can get 10 cross-Atlantic publishers who can back that claim up, right? And I know from when header bidding came out, I heard something similar from a publisher on this side of the waters, right? You know, but if you can get someone to back that claim up, or a bunch of people to back that claim up, that gives a lot more weighting. Because the allegations that we have right now, and to keep the politics in the mix, only work because you have insiders giving information, right? Or you have affected parties giving information. To turn it from a he said, she said into something concrete, it needs to be a case of somebody either surfacing, a series or thread or Slack channel or something else or another that shows you a full history of how this was going to be implemented, right? A bunch of publishers that have a pretty large grievance, right? Sort of a similar fervor, I guess, if you'd call it that, for seeing Google Pay, to also show up and have discussion. Because in my head, I thought, Project Bernanke, what an interesting name, because obviously, you know, Ben Bernanke being the head of the Federal Reserve for a couple of terms, and it's like, their job is to fix rates, right? It's such a weird nuance, as it were. So I thought to myself, with what is being alleged here, it would make sense if Google start divesting their business. I mean, I think they are much better placed to do this than Meta are. You know, Meta are doing it because they kind of have to right now. It's so important for their business spirit to survive moving forward. The fact that Alphabet exists, there's no reason why DFP can't be spun off, right? Or the ad services, exactly, of the business unit, you know, and then have YouTube have some level of autonomy. You can still have, you know, a favored nation relationship, right? And that's legally permissible, you know, in sort of in the way in which, you know, PayPal and eBay operated, or I suppose operate, you know, for a while, right? It's that beneficial, or the eBay Gumtree relationship. There's allowances for that in the law, and having it under the umbrella of Alphabet makes sense. But if you're forced to do that, what happened to Microsoft after their antitrust absolutely ruined the market for them? They spent a long time reinventing themselves, and obviously gave a lot of space for Apple to rise and become who it is today.
Which is exactly why I just can't imagine that execs at Google aren't already working on this sort of potential proposal behind the scenes, because this could very, very, you know, possibly come down to a deal done in a legal context rather than having the case progressed any further. And surely that would be one of the options that you're willing to put on the table. It just feels like it's a logical move at this stage, you know, and then plus, like I said, you must just be so sick of being raked over the hot coals every time somebody makes a complaint about you. And also the arguments are just becoming so threadbare, you know, this whole notion that every time somebody accuses them of anti-competition, they try to come round it from another angle and say, no, actually, we were trying to boost competition. We were doing this with our good friends at Facebook. It's like, come on, guys, you really are sounding like the Conservative Party. So, you know, take some action. Sorry, Grace, turned it into a political podcast.
No worries. I mean, the parallels are very clear. So I'm sure our listeners will be coming to those conclusions anyway, even if we hadn't brought it up. Very interesting discussion. I'm sure it won't be the last we hear of lawsuits and Google and Facebook for that matter. But we'll move on to our second story of the week, which is not moving too far because it's also to do with Google. Google Analytics this time, which has been accused of breaching GDPR for sharing data collected on an Austrian website with the US. Earlier this month, Austria's data regulator, Datenschutzbehörde, apologies to any German-speaking listeners.
No, well done. You did that very well, Grace. I think you got some tutorage from Lindsay Roundtree on that, our German speaker at Exchange.
I may well have done. Ruled that information gathered by the service on the nation's version of NetDoctor was not afforded suitable protection from potential access by US intelligence agencies. The decision comes hot on the heels of a conclusion by the European Data Protection Supervisor that the EU Parliament's COVID-19 testing website had fallen foul of the legislation by also using analytics. The two rulings are the first to have been made after the removal of the US-EU Privacy Shield, which was deemed illegal under EU data protection legislation in July 2020. Commentators expect that the cases will put pressure on both sides to put a new framework in place to prevent other US cloud services from facing the same complaint. Whilst not universally applicable, the NetDoctor ruling could be the start of a change in how data transfers between the EU and US are regulated. NOIB, the legal non-profit organisation who brought the case in 2020, also filed 100 other complaints with the same legal arguments, which are currently under investigation by regulators across 30 European countries. I guess my first question with this is, considering, you know, the number of complaints that have been filed by NOIB, you know, 100 other ones across Europe, do you think we'll soon be seeing more cases like the NetDoctor one? And do you think any of them could end with, you know, cloud services being barred from European countries? Rachel, I'll come to you first this time.
Do I think that there might be more cases brought forward? I'm afraid I do, because I think, you know, having read, you know, this article, which is actually quite lengthy and detailed, and then some other bits and pieces of information relating to it. And also we discussed the original Privacy Shield case actually on the podcast back in late 2019, before the case was then decided in 2020. I think this is, it's obviously not clear cut. It's quite detailed and protracted and not exactly opaque, but I think you've got to be a bit more of a legislative expert than I am to fully understand the depth of everything that's being argued here. But I think it's relatively clear cut that we are talking about cloud-based services that do actually contravene GDPR. And at the end of the day, if they contravene that legislation, then something has to change. It's quite clear to me that GDPR legislation, whilst it might mature, shall we say, over time as it gets tested and challenged in court and in various arguments and situations such as this. We always argued in the early days of the application of GDPR that it would get tested over time and probably the legislation would then morph a little bit accordingly. So no doubt that's what's going to happen in this case. But I'm afraid to say that I think it's a really good example of where an existing piece of legislation that protected people's the sharing of people's data across physical borders just hasn't been adequately replaced. And so therefore what we've currently got in place, it completely contravenes GDPR legislation, and something needs to be done about that really quickly. And the reason why I feel a little bit uppity about this is because I think the European Union, and I think European countries in general, are right about this. You know, people's data needs to be very clearly protected, and that needs to be enshrined in legislation, and that must cross borders, physical borders and boundaries, because the internet doesn't cross those physical borders and boundaries. So we know our data can go anywhere. So there needs to be something in place that means that we are protected from our data being used for other purposes elsewhere. And if we think about this sort of issue on a day-to-day basis, what difference does it really make to me, the average internet user, et cetera? And maybe a lot of that data is anonymized to a certain extent. Maybe it doesn't really matter. But the point is, it is potentially going into the hands of people that can use it for far greater things. And I'm not talking about sort of bad actors or nefarious entities. I'm talking about surveillance and intelligence services. And I think it's really important that there are very clear legal boundaries about what surveillance and intelligence services can use and what permissions they require from citizens. And that also, that is an issue of sovereignty. Never mind Brexit, that was a whole load of bollocks. Here we are getting political again. No one's ever going to invite me back on the podcast, which is fair enough. But this is actually an issue of sovereignty. This is my data. I understand what happens to it in the UK. I know we're now no longer part of the EU, but imagine for a minute we are. I understand what happens to it in other European Union countries. I need to understand what happens to it in the US. And so therefore there needs to be some legislation that accurately sort of enshrines that. And I think, so for me, I think this is a clear-cut example of the existing legislation not being fit for purpose and needs to be updated. We can't wait for technology organisations to start doing things differently and modifying their products, because we know they're going to be slow to do that or reluctant to do it. And so I think that legislators need to intervene and get on with it.
I think, it's funny because in my head, what I really think is at play here, and Rach, you've hit it on the head, is there is a real tension between the legal framework, I guess, and what the law permits and the reality of how the how our interconnected world works, right? And unfortunately, we keep designing these laws that don't reflect how things actually work in real life, right? And this tension needs to be resolved. And I look at this article and I think props to Max Schrems, right?
He 100%. Keeps marching
on and is challenging and pushing the boundaries in the right ways in which he should, right? In which we should all be mindful of. And obviously it's going to make for a lot of discomfort for us in the interim. But it does encourage governments a lot more to get on with this work. The challenge that we have here is that, again, I think there is a disincentive for any of the big tech players to do anything with this, right? Because there is no financial hit to them. It just means the governments can't do their job, and the governments then have to go and do things. And we know how quickly, or more precisely, slowly, bureaucratic processes are. And I think that's all. For me, the concern in this is that if GA is not fit for purpose in Austria and it's ruled the same in other EU countries, I'm almost willing to bet that Ireland's going to rule differently, right? If it's not fit for purpose in other countries, then what does that mean for Adobe Analytics? And what does it mean for Microsoft and Azure and its cloud services? What does it mean for AWS, right? Are we going to go down into a world in which we're also talking about how Office 365 works? My concern is really, where does this stop, right? You've got someone like SpaceX and Starlink, right, who are putting satellites up and they're getting ready to give internet connectivity to the masses, right? That is naturally, as part of their business, going to include businesses too, So if I, as a business owner, decide to use Starlink's satellite network, what does GDPR mean for that? Because I'm pretty certain that that's going to reside somewhere on SpaceX servers, you know, in the US, which is open to interception, open to, you know, to government subpoenas, right, to access the data. Now, I think that Google potentially has a really interesting out in this, and so does Amazon and also Microsoft with their data centers globally, because you have physical structures that can house the data in different regions. You know, I once upon a time designed a solution for European government agency, right, to handle their analytics and their advertising structure. And, you know, it was very important for us when we're sort of looking and thinking about the potential ramifications of the GDPR, et cetera, to think about how or where we locate the servers, right? And then also think about what the redundancies look like, right? So Frankfurt, for example, and then making sure that London is a redundancy, and, you know, and keeping all within the EU zone, basically, right? That for me seems like something that isn't a massive challenge for Google to fix. And I'd even go a step further to say that if they, to marry the last conversation, the last topic into this one, if they were thinking a lot more about how to diversify their business, then you potentially make GA and GCP inseparable, right? And so your backup goes into GCP and you have it located in or physically stored in a data center in that area. It doesn't protect you from everything you want it to, because you can still have a US government, you know, still subpoenaing Google for information, but at least it gives you the protection of I'm doing everything I can, you know, within the right context. And I feel that from an information security perspective gives Google probably a much better stance, and also helps to ward off some of these long-term concerns, because until we work out how the GDPR really works in real life and how we actually all access the internet, then we can't fix these issues properly. You know, it's in my mind, this is almost like the academic version of what was the real life consequence of Huawei being banned in the UK from putting up actual hardware. You know, this is the version of how we transfer data to the US. So we need to think very carefully about how we apply these laws. And I guess maybe the big lesson for the EU here is that as we write these laws, yes, we have the right intention, and yes, we understand what we want to protect the user from, and it's right to do those things. But importantly, how does that translate into real life and into making sure that, you know, we not enter into a space where the wrong actors, bad or benign, right, can get their hands on things they shouldn't do?
I completely agree with you. That's what, you know, all really well said, Femi, because I think that's what I was, you know, rather rantingly trying to get at, is that never mind what, you know, what might be demanded of some of these cloud service providers or, you know, any of the data sharing sort of entities or any data sharing activities that we might undertake over time and in a court of law. The point is those things are always going to be up for inspection and interrogation and argument. The point is rather trying to find a way to implement the legislation in a usable, practical day-to-day capacity, but that still protects my rights as an individual. Because, and see, where I think where I'm going with this is that I just think GDPR to some extent was certainly, you know, sort of dreamt up perhaps by legislators that were not experts in the way that information is shared and transacted across the internet. Thus, you know, we're left with this sort of slightly clunky legislation that, as we've both said, is kind of getting tested and amended over time. But it also comes from a really good place, which that is, it's very important to protect people's data privacy.
Absolutely.
And that needs to be something that is enshrined in every country's sovereign laws and needs to be respected by other countries. And the thought of the US being able to sort of implement, just as an example, implement a kind of data sharing protocol that says, yeah, we'll mostly pay attention to that, except when it comes to US surveillance and security, and then we won't pay attention to that at all. We'll just do what we want. Needs to be something that stops that happening. And then I also agree with everything that you said. It also needs to be something kind of completely, you know, practical and usable and and not getting in the way of businesses doing business and making money. But I firmly believe that. We could get there, and certainly some of the big tech companies could get there a lot faster than, you know, if they actually put their minds to it. The reason I said we can't look to them necessarily for speedy change is because they're just not prioritizing it. It's not important enough to them, right? They still really discard European privacy legislation as a bit of an irritation. And we agree it is irritating, but the point is, if you get your house in order and understand how that legislation operates, and if that legislation also gets refined over time through legal challenges and what have you, then we'll all be in a better place. And that's really important. Europeans know how to protect people's privacy. A lot of other countries don't. Asian countries, really good examples of not caring at all. And I feel strongly that we need to follow a European example in that context.
No, I completely agree. And I think that, you know, the challenge here is, at least from a big tech perspective, until it hurts their pockets, they don't really care. And perhaps the follow-up to this is that whenever the rulings get decided, you know, and the highest court in the land upholds them, then a fine follows immediately, right? And that becomes a way of getting the attention to say that, okay, this is obviously not acceptable, but we will do the one thing that you understand, which is take money out of your pocket. And that, if we look at sort of at least how sort of GDPR has been enforced so far, that has been the one big stick that works well. You know, if you have to pay a fine, right, regardless of, I mean, obviously they're still eye-watering amounts, but they're still tiny amounts of total profit, right? But if you have to pay a fine and it's knocking on over €500 million, euros, then that's good. Enough of those. If you get 100 of those, if all this goes through, right, that's going to stack up. And at least at that point in time, you will get the kind of change that you want to see. But if that doesn't happen, this is by and large an academic exercise for most of the big tech companies.
I think you're probably right.
It'll be interesting to see how this develops. And, I'm sure there will be some sort of framework put in place. I mean, surely there has to be with the number of complaints that have been filed with the lack of one. But we'll move on to our final story of this week, which is Microsoft's acquisition of gaming giant Activision Blizzard has seen much speculation about the future of gaming, with commentators fearing that the deal would dampen competition in the market. Coming 2 years after the company's purchase of ZeniMax, the acquisition shows beyond a doubt that Microsoft is extremely committed to dominating the video game market and could give the Xbox maker a monopoly, according to The Guardian's Kezia McDonald. While the implications of the deal for creative teams are unclear, there's significant concern that the move will see competition within the already narrow market, which is dominated by Microsoft, Sony, and Nintendo, decline. The move could also put the firm in prime position to capitalize off the emerging metaverse, says McDonald, and help them build on their Game Pass subscription service to realize their ambition to become the Netflix of gaming. With no other gaming companies offering a similar product and their catalog set to substantially increase, Microsoft could not only stand to profit disproportionately from the market, but also to have a far greater control over how players access and enjoy the games of the future. So I've seen a lot of pessimism towards this acquisition online, lots of articles expressing fear that it's just going to, you know, make an already very tight market, you know, even narrower, and give Microsoft a really disproportionate hold over the market. But do you agree? Do you think that this will be a, you know, catastrophic move, or do you think there could be some positives to it? Femi, I'll come to you first.
I'll start by saying, so I'm a big believer in sort of first principles marketing, right? And so there's a particular law that comes to mind, which is the law of duality, right? Which basically says in every category, every race becomes a two-horse race, right? So in that regard, I think that this is a natural thing that was going to happen anyway. And I get the pessimism. I understand, based on the way that Microsoft has treated previous purchases and the way it sort of ring-fenced them, if we want to be polite about it, right, in exclusivity, this looks like a bad thing, right? Because ABK is a massive acquisition, right? It is understated just how penetrative their business is across the board. Having said that, I see this more as the cheapest way for Microsoft to get into the metaverse quickly. Because unless you've played World of Warcraft, it is very hard to understand just how much of a template that is for the metaverse, even StarCraft, right? You know, these are the original metaverses that have existed for 15, 20 years, right? And they have a lot of people that are committed. Probably spent too much time in there, right? You know, but they have a lot of people that are that have the blueprints of how this can work in the long run and apply to wider society. So I see this almost as an investment to get into an area in which Facebook is obviously committed very heavily into, right? Or Meta, as they now know, is committed heavily into. You know, Google is trying to get into. And I think this deal allows them to kill a few birds with one stone. So from a Google perspective, Stadia has not done what it was supposed to do, right? And I think that this gives a chance for Microsoft to get a leg up in that regard and combine it with Xbox to have a proper, robust offering where you can really bring gaming to the masses. Many moons ago, I worked on the Activision account. So I'm aware of their business from a different angle, if you will, right? And I think that there are a few things that sort of struck out to me when I was sort of thinking about what this means for the whole. And so the first is, from a business perspective, I get why Activision sold, right? You know, stock prices drop in because the company's just got bad internal mojo, right? And bad things happen internally. And the CEO is you know, Bob Kotick is very, very much commercially driven. At least that was always my sort of my, the way in which Call of Duty works is it works like a theatrical release, right? Every year, right? You know, there were conversations that, that in effect stops just shy of blaming media and marketing for an unsuccessful product launch, right? Because it was like, well, everything's getting up towards this date. Why is it that, you know, we're not sending the numbers? And it can, like, there's so many factors that influence this. You can't blame your media investment alone, but that's how commercially minded they are. So I can see how the focus on the big number alone is what drove the acquisition and also what drives the bad company culture. The second thing I think that needs to be bear in mind is of all the acquisitions and the dynamics going on here, you've really got the West versus the East as a top level, because Tencent is hoovering up properties left, right, and center, right? And in reality, if I was Microsoft, I'm preparing an argument. The logic needs to be, who would you rather ABK be owned by? Tencent or US company, right? And that makes it a very different kind of conversation, because it's not whether or not the deal should go through. Someone has to buy them, right? And somebody will buy them. It's just a case of, you know, where do you want the, who do you want
to be? Better it be one of our own.
Exactly, right. And that sort of is, I think, how I'd frame it. And then I think, you know, from my end, I mean, I still remember very distinctly, and I use it anecdotally, when Candy Crush, so I used to work for a publisher ad server many, many moons ago. And I remember when conversations ended with King and Candy Crush over deploying a publisher ad server because they decided to take all advertising off their apps because they made more money from in-game purchases than they did from advertising ever could, right? And so I see sort of Activision and the Call of Duty franchise and sort of what Activision has within it as a real big investment in the I guess, in a new way of doing business, right? And an ability to use and leverage those servers to have like a Stadia style solution. I see Blizzard as the entry point into the metaverse and the blueprint for something that has tried and tested and worked for well over a decade, right? And then I see King as a way of expanding that to the masses and bringing all those into basically every device available, right? So this, you've got this three-headed monster, this Cerberus, if you will, right? At Microsoft's fingertips. And I think that that gives them a position that is probably more important than whether or not they choose to lock out Call of Duty from Sony, right? And if I was Sony, another account I've been exposed to actually, the concern is not so much about whether or not you can now sell ABK's franchises on your console, right, or through your own. It's what is Microsoft's plan to counter Sony's plan, where they're now turning their games and funding them through their studios into movies to make additional revenue. Because Sony starts to sell Marvel, right? And they want to have that kind of cinematic universe. And I think Uncharted comes out, it's not a plug, by the way, for Uncharted, but, you know, Uncharted comes out as a movie at some point this year. But you can see that trend basically happening where Sony's taking their IP, turn it into movies, expose it to a wider audience. That's the big play that I think Microsoft is going after. Not so much the gaming community. It's how do I bring, how do I take a whole bunch of users, a very, very sophisticated set of targeting and user information that exists. I've seen the cohorts that exist, and that's where I first came across all the proper idea of cohorts that exist under the ABK titles, right? And they are very, very sophisticated. How do I take all those users, all that data, and all that all that reach that comes from King, leverage those with the servers and what is going to be, quite frankly, better latency and better equipment than Microsoft has, believe it or not. And then how do I bring that to the masses and turn it all into one massive product so that whether you're at work or you're at play, you're running through a Microsoft system regardless.
I mean, wow, Femi, I'm so glad that we've got you talking about this on the podcast because that was just such a comprehensive rundown and fascinating to listen to. I have to say, I've got one question for you, which is when I was thinking about this story, and I know nothing about gaming. I know nothing about the games that you just talked about, except that they're games and really popular and loads of other people play them. But the thing I was thinking about was how far off. And so I want to pose this question to you. How far off is some kind of operational metaverse, which entails, like, you know, credible commercial opportunities, whether that's for brands or marketers or infrastructure providers via advertising or subscriptions or selling hardware? Like how far off do you think that the metaverse is as a potential marketplace, combining all of those things that you've just tied together there?
I think it is a spectrum. So it's funny because I was talking to someone internally about sort of the concept of general AI yesterday, and this is not a complete tangent. It is related, I promise. Right. But, you know, AI in the way in which we understand it in terms of sort of a sentient being, right, is something that is very, very far off. You know, you turn a machine on and you tell it to describe its environment. It tells you everything that a human being would, right? That stuff is very, very, very far off in the future. Something that does one thing really well as AI is something that we can see happening in the next 3 to 5 years, right? And if you wanted something that could do multiple things and you couple a whole bunch of things together, I think the same is true for the metaverse. If you think about it in context, we've had a mainstream version of the metaverse for at least 3-4 years in Pokemon Go, right? That is a mixed reality version in which you are both here and both somewhere else simultaneously at the same time. Right. You don't have to be, this is not Ready Player One where we all go into pods and, you know, put headsets on and then sort of disappear into the other world and live our lives there. And then hopefully just take bathroom breaks and sort of food breaks. I don't think that is a version of the metaverse that will work well for the majority of people. I think one in which their phone becomes a mixed reality device and let them interact with things that are potentially not physically visible, right? I think are really interesting. And I think that's where the hardware really comes to play, because the biggest challenge right now to having any kind of credible metaverse is how much it costs to invest in that. Because our phones are now what? Priced at 700, 800, 1,000 quid, right?
1,000 quid,
you know, offline, they are very credible, proper
pieces devices. Of hardware, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? They're mini machines in their own right. I still remember when Apple discontinued their white unibody Max, right? And that was because the iPhone became a £700 phone. So you couldn't have a full laptop that's cost of 750, right? It didn't make sense from a marketing perspective. So, it's that same logic of if your phone is capable of it costs so much and is capable of so much, then that becomes a natural interface for you to then interact with different aspects, you know, of the metaverse. And then if you want to afford it, right, or if you're a business and it's part of your objectives and the way in which you want to interact, then you can give your employees headsets and other things to allow them to do that, you know, and then to fully delve in. So, you know, it might be that as a company, instead of getting, you know, headsets with mics, you also get one that has a headset, you know, with an Oculus style sort of augmented reality or VR type headset. And then I think that for us, the question is, software is capable, right? Hardware is probably not going to be standalone. right? Because it limits the areas in which you can interact. And the whole point of the metaverse is that you want to technically turn the entire Earth into a massive puzzle of sorts, right? You know, for you to go and explore, and that's how you build it out. And for you to do that, you need something that's portable. So it has to be your phone, you know, or some other device that we haven't seen what it turns into yet, but something that basically can go with you anywhere you want in the world. And as long as it has charge, you can then access, you know, whatever portal exists within that particular area.
So you're taking your Spectrum example into play here. That's just around the corner. Then that's not far off, right?
No, it's not. I think on the near end of the Spectrum, you know, we've seen it in play, right? Unless you play Pokemon Go, you wouldn't really get it, right? But the moment that there is some sort of either mass event that we can use to make that happen, right? You know, then we have a chance to test the metaverse out, you know, en masse, right? And it needs us to have, technically speaking, we could, if someone is thinking about it, do it end of this year with the World Cup, right? Largest sports event in the world, right? It's in Qatar. Have a bunch of people flocking down. You could have a way to interact with the World Cup in a way that puts you there without being there, right? As long as you go to X, Y, and Z location, or you're near this, you know, basically you almost have like portals, right? Which is what you have in World Warcraft, right? You know, you have these portals that will let you then be able to interact with the metaverse in that particular location. I think that is a very near-term thing. Having a world in which we are all fully immersed and I have to be shut off from my physical world, I think is still 5-6 years away, because hardware costs money, right? And I'm not, if we're going to keep things in sort of socioeconomic terms, with the rising cost of living right now, no one's shelling out 300 quid for a pair of headset if you're going to be concerned about your bills and your heating throughout winter. You know, so it's one of those things where I think hardware, as long as it's portable, mixed reality is definitely now, full immersive, otherworldly, shut off to my physical world reality is a few years away.
That's fascinating. I haven't, I've had so many conversations with people about the Microsoft AB stuff over the last sort of week or so, and everyone's talked about, you know, whether it's them going hard on, I mean, obviously it's about the metaverse for them, but is it them, initially going hard on metaverse, or is it them initially going hard on, chasing down users and maxing out their subs model and all the rest of it? But hearing you describe it in that way makes me feel like not only is it deeply immersed in their ambitions around the metaverse, but that's something that they could really kind of be monetizing and doing some really exciting things with sooner rather than later. And personally, I really like the idea of that, because as a non-gamer, I totally want to get into all of this, but I'm just one of those people that unless the trend is there and really accessible, so I'll be the person that when it is available on my phone, I'll be like, this is amazing. Have you guys seen what this can do? And the rest of the world will be going, yeah, we've been playing around with that for like the last 20 years. So I think that would be super exciting.
No, I think it will be too. I think, I genuinely think that Microsoft, if they execute this right, have made a genius move, because they've hit it on all three aspects they need to, right? And it's not any one of them that's going to give them the upper hand. It's all three together, and it turns into a two-horse race. I don't think they're going to displace Sony, because Sony's IP is rich enough for them to make movies out of and get the big bucks. But I think that they can really transform technology if they do this properly.
That is absolutely fascinating and very exciting by the sounds of it. I'm very exciting for Microsoft, especially at the minute. We'll move on to the second part of the podcast, where we just talk to you a bit more, Femi, about what you're working on and what's been of interest to you. So what kinds of things have been going on at Assembly in the new year, and what have you been focusing on?
Yeah, well, right now it's pitch season. Again, I think... yeah, I'm always pitching, you know. So ABP, always be pitching.
You want a job in our sales team, Femi? That's exactly what our sales team says all the time.
So it's for my end, it's pretty intense, because it's a lot of POVs, a lot of sort of thought leadership internally. Like we literally I jumped online this morning and we spent a good 90 minutes just debriefing on flocky now topics, right? And sort of The discussion's still going on now, actually, on Teams. And it's like sort of, oh, here's what the GitHub says and here's what I think is going to happen. So it, for us, it's a lot about not so much finding a stable position, but just almost like finding new points and new positions to be able to bring into our pitches, because we're mindful that everyone's going to have the same basic kind of understanding of things. So a lot of my time right now is spent on pitching, and also on making sure that that at least my mind has been sharpened by the other smart people in the organization who have good contributions to make. You know, we have a very, very good connected team. By that I mean that, you know, we talk well with US, we talk well with Hong Kong and Romina. So, you know, I'm always getting different opinions very often, which is really, really good from my side. And then besides that, I mean, bulk of my job is consultancy, right? So it's always making sure that our clients have a provocative viewpoint, I think is probably the best way to put it. You know, how best can we voice the unpopular opinion in the room, or at least ask in a tactful way that lets us have a better conversation moving forward. So yeah, that's what January's looked like so far. It's just heavyweight pitches, a lot of internal conversations, and then the day job.
I suppose it's probably a whole load of stuff that you can't share with us, but I'm just interested in the idea that you're always looking for a sort of fresh angle for your clients, obviously. And I don't know whether there's any thoughts that you can share with us about sort of big areas of concern for marketing and advertising in the coming 12 months. I mean, they're all very obvious, right? But, you know, what are there some things that are coming up for you guys, or even from clients that are coming to you and requesting your pitches and so forth? Are there some particular trends that are coming up that are interesting? A fresh take, I suppose, on, you know, how do we deal with marketing and advertising beyond third-party cookies? How are we going to be handling things like measurement and attribution in the future?
Yeah, I mean, and those two are probably the top two questions we actually get asked. So it is about sort of what our take is on attribution, right? And from our end, we're working on a product that I can't go into details of, but you know, we're sourcing alpha clients or alpha partners to test it out on, which is around what attribution looks like. The fortunate thing about Assembly is that because we're digital first, we see the world from a very different way, you know, and it still works into the omni-channel offline piece, but it means that we look at the metrics from a very different way. And so we have some very, very clever people who are basically sort of looking at attribution from if I can shorten the MMM life cycle, what would it look like? Right. And what does that give? And you know, what do we need to bolt on, and how do we make it cheaper and faster market, you know, all those kind of things. And then, yeah, there is, you know, and it's not going to, today's news is not going to help, right? But, you know, there is still the third party cookie deprecation issue, right? And for us, I think the conversation is now credibly shifted from what this could mean to what opportunities are there for us to be able to leverage this specifically in our own right for ourselves, you know, because I think the one thing that is becoming more and more obvious is, and I don't blame them because it's a function of how their market works, right? Or how the market works. Google's developed solutions that are clearly tech focused because it's Chrome, right? It's a tech solution. Their tech team, I get it, right? And it should be that way. But, and Topics, I guess, probably comes the closest to it, but it's hard to see how this enables or empowers brands to talk to publishers more directly, you know, with the solution they have in place. And I think that is maybe one of the bigger concerns that agencies have. I don't know if they all have it. From our end, that is pretty much all we obsess on, right? Which is our motto, our strap line, if you will, our guiding mission statement is to find the change that fuels growth. Right. So for us, we're obsessing over what these little nuances are and the subtext of all these industry changes that are opportunities to test what means change and then convert that into something that means growth. Right. So for us, it's like the conversation now is, if this is what Google's going to offer the industry, then what can we take off the back of that? Right. And then offer our clients as a way of them talking to the places where the users are, because the users are on Chrome, but Chrome is a facilitator, not the destination, right? You know, so how do they talk to the Financial Times or to Vogue or to Condé Nast, if you're brand X or Y, and what does that mean for us as an organization? So, one of my big tasks for this year is helping a lot of our clients who have the desire, should we say, or maintain the desire to in-house on how to do that properly. Because it's normally a naughty word when it comes to agency land. But we've learned to lean into it because it's all swings and roundabouts, right? In-house this year, in 5 years' time, you'll want to outsource for whatever reason it
outsource
is.
Again. Yeah.
Exactly, but it's about making sure that we are good partners and good effective partners for all of our clients. And that means that we have to, we have to refine the proposition. We had one for last year, evaluated it. Is it still fit for purpose? Some parts yes, some parts no. What does that look like now? How do we help them in the housing journey? How do we bring all of the agents to bear? So you're not just dealing with just MarTech experts only or just your activation teams, but, can our talent team help you with, interviews? And can our people team help you with local laws and areas in which we have offices, as it were, for global distributed teams. So it's much more about being intentional, I guess, from our end and making sure that we help our clients with those questions because they do ask us. And it's random things like that.
And that feels quite nuanced, right? Which is reflecting how the industry is changing. Like you said, trying to work with your clients on a bespoke basis, and sort of if it is about thinking about how they can bring some of those capabilities in-house, it's about specifying those and maybe setting that up for clients of certain sizes, but not recommending it for clients of other sizes. And that is becoming a sort of a much more of a reflective way for brands to consider in-housing their capabilities. And that also feels like it's coming across in the way that people are interpreting some of the issues that we just talked about as well. So your reflection that actually people are coming to you with those two big major issues, but the conversation isn't what are we going to do or how is this going to impact our business? It's actually rather how are we going to organize ourselves to maximize the opportunities from these changes. And that, I think, is something that's familiar to us in the tone of conversation that we're getting from all corners of the industry. As we're just coming into 2020 and we're planning out our year of ATS events and we're thinking about the main topics that we're going to be focusing on, as well as all of our day-to-day content, the conversation is definitely shifting much more towards action and not, because the deadline's looming, but rather, okay, what actually can we do to improve our businesses as a result of these changes? And like I said, that's coming from all angles, from brands, from publishers, from agencies. So that's really interesting to hear that it's more or less reflected in what you've said too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's, I feel like, and I said at ATS London, I feel like we're entering an age of reckoning, right? And maybe this is part of what we're seeing show up in the antitrust lawsuits. But I think there's going to be a need for accountability. And I feel like the publishers have had their age of reckoning. The agencies have definitely, had their age of reckoning. I feel like some of our more cognizant brands, they can see the change happening where their age of reckoning is coming to. And I think that they'll probably more than not need a friend and a partner, right, to help guide them through that, and we're almost, readying ourselves for it, So for us, I mentioned at the very beginning, we've got sort of these inflection points that we've charted over the next 18 months, right? And there's the tech ones, and there's sort of the internal ones that we think are coming, and then there are industry ones, and then sort of one of them is the fact that, at this point in time, brands are going to wake up and realize that, things are not as they thought they were, right? The alliances they had before, are failing, right? So how do they have somebody who can act in their best interests, but in an honest way, right? So not just we don't want to replace one set of shady practices for another, right? All in the sake of doing it for the brand. We want to be authentic and honest and be purpose-driven, but while also making sure that we are still turning a profit. And how do we be a good partner, to you in that sense. So that really is, I guess, our guiding principle, which is just, how can we be better for our clients and for our people?
Well, it sounds like it's going to be a very busy next 18 months and beyond.
Absolutely, absolutely.
But we'll leave it there. We do appreciate you coming on and giving us your time and your expertise, Femi, especially on the metaverse. That was a really, really great listen, and I'd love to learn more about it from you. So I'm sure we'll be in touch with content if you're up for it.
Yeah, definitely. Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it, and I love listening to the podcast as well. So it's good to be on this side of it for a change.
Great to have a fan on the podcast.
Absolutely. And thank you, Rachel, as well, for joining us.
It's always my pleasure to be involved in the podcast too.
Wonderful. And thank you, everyone, for listening. That was this week's Mad Tech Podcast.